thank you so much for coming. Welcome to LSE. And thank you for coming to this event, 25 years beyond 1325, reimagining, and I think we can also add reflecting upon, the United Nations Women, Peace, and Security Agenda. And I am so pleased to welcome you here to the Hong Kong Theater today. I just want to note and acknowledge that this event is hosted by LSE Gender, LSE International Relations, the LSE Center for Women, Peace, and Security, as well as the Canadian Research Network on Women, Peace, and Security. As you may know, this roundtable is set in part to mark the 25th anniversary of the Women, Peace, and Security Agenda with a critical, but also, we hope, constructive lens. It may be useful for us to recall that the UN Women, Peace, and Security Agenda began with UN Security Council Resolution 1325 in October 2000, or in fact sometime before that. These things need organizing, after all. Resolution 1325 noted the disproportionate and distinct impact of armed conflict on women and girls. And so the resolution, to quote, reaffirms the important role of women in the prevention and resolution of conflicts, peace negotiations, peace building, peacekeeping, humanitarian response, and in post-conflict reconstruction, and stresses the importance of their equal protection and participation, pardon me, and full involvement in all efforts for the maintenance and promotion of women in peace and security. Resolution 1325 furthermore urges all actors to increase the participation of women and incorporate gender perspectives in all United Nations peace and security efforts. It also calls on all parties to conflict to take special measures to protect women and girls from gender-based violence, particularly rape and other forms of sexual abuse in situations of armed conflict. Over the next 25 years, the agenda expanded with another 9 UN Security Council resolutions, large civil society and advocacy community, and a host of state, regional, and international organization policies, programs, and so forth. I am Kate Miller. I'm an associate professor in the IR department here at the London School of Economics, and I will be chairing the panel for this evening. This panel brings together 4 leading experts in the policy, practical, and conceptual aspects of gender and international security. And our discussion is going to examine the agenda's legacy, so its milestones, limitations, as well as some pretty significant tensions that have shaped its trajectory. Our panel members are Nancy Anon, assistant professor at the Center for Peace and Security, Coventry University, Aiko Holvakivi, whom I believe some of you may know, assistant professor of gender, peace, and security at the Department of Gender Studies, and an associate academic at the Center for Women, Peace, and Security here at LSE. Paul Kirby, reader in international politics at Queen Mary University of London. And Stephanie von Lutke, the Canada Research Chair on Gender, Security, and the Armed Forces, professor of political studies at Queen's University, and fellow with the Pierre Elliott Trudeau Foundation. So how the event will proceed is I'm going to invite each of our speakers to speak for around and up to 12 minutes, offering their thoughts on the past and future of the Women, Peace, and Security Agenda, and then we are going to turn it over to yourselves in the audience for questions. Please note the event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. Please also, as there are a number of us here, just note where the emergency exits are in the room. And for the Q&A part of today's event, I will let you know when we open the floor for questions, and we will do sort of a typical procedure. Raise your hand, and one of our colleagues on the stewarding team will bring you a microphone so that we can all communicate. For now, I am delighted to hand over to our panel to begin, starting with Paul, please.
Thank you so much, Kate. I hope everyone can hear me okay. So it's an anniversary event, but perhaps more of an unhappy birthday than a happy one, and I'll try and elaborate on that in a piece which I'm currently calling Awake for Women, Peace and Security. And I'm going to read a bit, and I hope that's all right with you. On an overcast Tuesday in late 2024, I was dispatched to the Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office to plead for women, peace and security. A Labour government was newly in office, ending 15 years of Conservative hegemony, almost entirely coextensive with UK WPS policy. Though in theory more amenable to gender equality, Labour's plans were not yet known. Earlier overtures of a feminist development policy had been jettisoned, and the government was already disappointing on Gaza. But they had also pledged action on gender violence at home and promised to rebuild Britain's reputation on international development, in the words of their election manifesto. I was standing in for a civil society network and a delegation of a dozen, meeting Annalise Dodds, the Minister for Development, Women and Equalities. A major NGO director had flown in specially from Asia. Advocacy was afoot. I arrived early to a massing protest. Plaintive songs crackled out from cheap megaphones as a delegation of predominantly women, several with their children, carefully deposited washing lines of baby clothes outside the carriage gate of what had first been the British India and then the colonial and only more recently the Foreign Office. Demands for an arms embargo scrawled on cardboard, kaffirs in all colours, Palestinian flags. I circled for a bit, approximating respectful distance, took some pictures, choked down a lump, and stepped over the ghosts as tenderly as I could. In the end, the minister did not show, called away on an urgent question on the expulsion of the UN Reliefs and Works Agency by the Israeli Knesset. In Parliament, she reiterated the government's position that, quote, we will not tolerate any more excuses on humanitarian assistance. No more excuses. That was a year ago. The delegation delivered our rehearsed talking points to her special advisers, and I limped home, dejected and wet. The scene could have played out with minor variations at almost any point in the first 25 years of WPS. Failure and frustration are, after all, the leitmotifs of the agenda. The failure to properly implement, a failure of states. The failure of WPS practice to be feminist enough, a failure of activists. And the failure of critique to relate to actual liberation struggles, a failure of academics. Failure is the lifeblood of WPS, maybe even its engine. But I want to suggest that on the 25th anniversary, we are in the midst of a more severe shift than that normal story, a twilight of Global North WPS. At the most obvious level, Donald Trump has returned to the American presidency with a mission to eviscerate gender and DEI as never before. US aid was effectively dismantled in a lightning purge lasting a few weeks, with deadly ramifications already evident. According to UN Women, plausibly half of the women-led organizations working in humanitarian crises expect to close by the end of this year. Pete Hegseth, the former Guantanamo Bay guard and Fox News host elevated to Secretary of War, crows that the agenda, pushed by feminists but hated by troops, is dead. Good riddance, WPS, he tweets, all capitals. There was briefly the possibility for others to counteract this damage, but allies and clients have largely followed Trump's lead, embellishing with their own excuses. The British government slashes aid by £6 billion, leaving a £12 billion off the legal target, which is endlessly deferred. Annalise Dodds resigned in articulate protest at that decision. Her replacement as development minister labelled aid charity and warned the parliamentary committee that there would be no special treatment for women and girls. References to WPS that had crept into the UK security reviews and strategies over many years evaporated. Some Whitehall gender teams are somewhat upbeat, noting that they have managed to secure budgets for this year, which counts for something. And yet the projections are for a collapse from 26-27 as the aid cuts bite. Already in 2022, the Swedish government had ditched feminist foreign policy. The incoming German Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, dismisses feminist language as needless baggage for a lean and transactional geopolitics. The Netherlands is cutting aid to 0.4% of gross national income. 18 global North states have lapsed national action plans. The wider picture is as grim. The OECD expects a drop in aid from its member states of as much as 17% this year. Of 27 countries in Europe and North America with a Women, Peace and Security National Action Plan, for which data was available, two-thirds have decreased their overseas development aid commitment agenda in the last years. The global percentage for projects with gender equality as their principal objective had indeed only ever inched upwards, never topping 6% of all aid. And these latest figures predate the second Trump term and can reasonably be treated as a high watermark. The savings are to be redistributed towards the military. At this year's NATO summit, member states who had turned away from WPS committed to defense spending at 5% of GDP. In the aftermath of the US bombing of Iran's nuclear sites, NATO Secretary General praises Trump as a man of peace and daddy. As we can maybe discuss, WPS and militaries are not anathema. And historically, more criticism has been leveled at the agenda for being too close to militarism than for any other failure. Certainly, Ukrainian feminists keep reminding us not to confuse imperialism with peace or armed resistance with patriarchy. But in practice, WPS funds, small as they are, have been redirected to the most traditional martial forms: troop recruitment, new kit, nuclear weapons, sovereign capabilities. At the United Nations Security Council, supreme seat of the agenda, WPS had started to fall apart even before Daddy's return. In 2024, there were only half the number of decisions integrating WPS language than at the 2017 peak. In the run-up to the 20th anniversary of 1325, 5 years ago, it was possible to complain of resolution fatigue and joke about the performative hyperactivity of open debates and the language that states would use at the Security Council. On the verge of the 25th, no such mood is possible. Some still hold to the old ways. Denmark has made WPS a priority of its Security Council tenure and expanded its fifth National Action Plan. Ireland issues its fourth. Norway co-organizes a communique recommitting dozens of states and organizations to the agenda. Canada agrees a security and defense partnership with the European Union that integrates WPS, quote, in all aspects, and pledges to counter setbacks against gender equality and the rights of women and girls. Spain increases its aid spend and codifies the 0.7% target into law. But these are rearguard actions. Of course, WPS is not the exclusive property of the global north, nor of states, nor of the multilateral institutions that so depend on first world donors. Its precipitous decline in North America and Europe, whether short-term or long, should not be mistaken with the end of WPS at large. Though we too often forget it, 1325 was driven institutionally by ambassadors that do not fit the caricature of white feminism: Namibia, Jamaica, Bangladesh. From the start, feminist activists used Resolution 1325 agilely. They may do so again. If you read accounts from the early years of WPS, you will get a sense of this: one UN document as a form of leverage amongst many. The growth of the agenda also means many more possible sources and champions for it. Even in formal policy terms, 5 years ago, almost as many national action plans came from outside the global north as from within it. By now, it is likely evens. Some may even find in this moment a liberation from the professionalization, the hierarchy, the bureaucracy, and the patronizing pedagogy that had come to characterize so many WPS interactions. The paramilitarization of the American border prevents many activists from even attending WPS Week in New York in this anniversary year. But in its place, they organize alternatives, centering global majority experience at events in Jordan, Kenya, and Malaysia. A different WPS geography comes into view. And yet, the progress narrative of WPS cannot be told, however grudgingly, without the contribution of Western governments. As the permissive cause on that fateful October, in the subsequent struggles over Security Council language, mandates, and special offices, in the millions spent on thousands of dispersed initiatives, in the Nobel Prizes and celebrity endorsements, or in the growing dependence of a professional cadre of WPS advocates and experts on government funds now earmarked for martial ends. What was the WPS that is now fading away? In our recent book, Laura Shepherd and I suggest that there is a better view of WPS as a dynamic and relational ecosystem, less a unified structure of law and governance than a field in which many different versions of feminist and some anti-feminist mobilization could happen under a common umbrella. That framework was useful for us as an alternative to the prevailing norms view and to help us think of the plural pasts and futures of the agenda. But it did not push us enough towards a characterization of the structural supports of WPS, one of which is, or was, surely the funds and attention secured by activists and femocrats in the global north. In international relations, we speak of the boomerang effect, where local activists gain influence over recalcitrant national governments by tapping into international agendas. There's a series of criticisms of that model that we can get into, but we can, I think, trace the precarious, insufficient, sometimes confounding coalitions that were made across a history of the agenda. A weak boomerang effect, if you like. Those channels were built not between states as abstract units, Washington, London, Oslo, but by people working within and across diverse government institutions, patching together what was possible, sometimes with surprising leeway. How often was this work at a tangent to the national interest or civilizational arrogance? Often enough. And not all of the instrumentalized or co-opted work was straightforwardly harmful. We may miss it when it is gone. Still, an imperfect feminist internationalism came into view and was crafted over the decades. Typically, the criticism is that such measures have emerged all too much from powerful institutions, according to their conceptions and misunderstandings, overly dependent on northern largesse, rather than genuinely connecting grassroots feminist movements with international allies. But less visible, genuinely hard to map and document at any scale, are the networks and initiatives across the global south that don't enjoy newspaper coverage or large donations, but make use of WPS beneath the radar and not always in the language of 1325. And so ours is a wary wake. We gather to mourn, to celebrate a life, to commiserate, to find new ways of keeping a memory alive. There are flowers and long speeches and a holdout hope that WPS may not be quite dead yet.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Paul, for that very strong opening. We'll now hand over to Nancy Anon.
Thank you very much. Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here and to be part of this critical yet constructive conversation around the WPS agenda, commemorating the 25th anniversary of the Resolution 1325. So thank you to the chair and the first speaker for setting the stage. And I think that today's the topic of today's event really is fitting because after 2.5 decades, with many new developments and changes in our world and societies, WPS cannot continue to be the same. It cannot remain business as usual. It has to change to fit the times, and also we should begin to reimagine a much improved and a holistic version which reflects the growing realities of women and girls all over the world. And indeed, as Kate and also Paul has mentioned, that Resolution 1325 and its supplementary frameworks has been very important because it has paved the way for women to have their voices heard in peace and security issues across different contexts and regions. But despite these achievements, there are also challenges and gaps, some of which Paul has really highlighted, which continues to limit the potential of the WPS agenda, hence the need to reflect and reimagine how we could strengthen it to be fit for purpose and now and in the future. And one aspect of the WPS agenda, which I believe requires a reimagining or at least some sort of reflection, is the element or the aspect of protection. How protection is understood and operationalized in the WPS agenda. So my presentation today is going to look at why it is important for the WPS to move beyond mere protection of women to maximizing women's agency in nonviolent forms of protection, or what has become known as unarmed civilian protection. So I'll touch a bit more on that. And I'll talk about this drawing on some of my research work that I've been doing on Cameroon and over the years. So as most of us know, protection is one of the four pillars of the WPS agenda, alongside prevention, participation, relief, and recovery. The protection pillar emphasizes protection of women and girls against sexual and gender-based violence and other human rights atrocities, especially in times of war and humanitarian emergencies. And these are enshrined in the 1325 itself, but also 1820 and other supplementary frameworks. However, these resolutions largely portray women as mere recipients of protection, especially by external parties, then overlooking their agency in protecting themselves and fellow civilians in times of conflict. So if you look at Articles 9 and 10 of 1320, the Resolution 2025, it calls on actors to respect fully international laws applicable to the rights and protection of women, and also calls on parties to armed conflict to take special measures to protect women and girls from gender-based violence. And this is good, this is commendable, because women and girls also need protection. But the way we portray women and girls in this resolution over the years has been as if they are damsels in distress, needing protection all the time. And so in general, we have seen that over the years, the WPS agenda continue to dominantly focus on the victimhood of women rather than their agency, especially when it comes to protection. And this perception and narrative of women with regards to protection is limited, is linked to the masculinized notion of security and protection, which is often focused on violence and on war rather than peaceful or nonviolent approaches. So in other words, protection is often seen as a masculine militarized intervention. And if you look at the UN Protection of Civilians agenda, it is mainly a masculine militarized endeavor led by peacekeeping and peace enforcement missions. And the WPS agenda has not done much to critique or challenge such militarized approach, hence tend to perpetuate the perception of women in conflict as needing protection, when in fact, these women are capable of doing so much more. They are resilient and proactive in their own protection. And Professor Diane Otto, in her piece on Women, Peace and Security, a critical analysis of the Security Council's vision, noted how the Security Council's dominant masculinized military approaches to securing peace cast women in a protective frame rather than equal participants in peace, in peacemaking and peace building, and there I add protection. She argues for a transformative anti-militarized culture and practices of peace, which I do agree, because dominant focus on militarized approaches to protection and peace overlooks women's agency in these areas. And one of such anti-militarized practice is unarmed or non-violent civilian protection, which I believe has a place in the Women, Peace and Security agenda going forward, so that there's a way to highlight the agency of women affected by conflict, so that these their protection efforts will be recognized. So what do I mean by unarmed civilian protection? So unarmed civilian protection is an evolving concept that that involves civilians using nonviolent strategies to protect fellow civilians from harm. So Aldenhouse and Co. defines UCP, as is popularly known, as the practice of civilians protecting other civilians in situations of imminent, ongoing, or recent violent conflict. So it marks a paradigmatic shift from what we know as protection of civilians traditionally, which is a military endeavor. This concept places people at the center of their own protection and enables them to employ nonviolent approaches to protecting themselves. And we have found that the women affected by conflict have been increasingly instrumental in using diverse forms of protection to protect themselves and their fellow women. And I think that going forward, the WPS agenda should really recognize these efforts women are making and really integrate them into the agenda and bringing their voices and their efforts into the more visibility to those. And I'm going to talk about a bit about experience in Cameroon, the research that my colleague Professor Gordon Crawford and I have been doing on this issue in the context of the Anglophone conflict, which is ongoing in the country's two English regions, Northwest and the Southwest. I don't know how many of you know Cameroon. Cameroon is in the central part of Africa, and it's a bilingual country, and it's been in conflict since 2017. And this conflict has really led to the death of over 6,000 people, women and children especially. But we still find women and children at the center of finding solutions, particularly with regards to protection in these situations. So And I'll share some of these experiences to demonstrate some of the nonviolent interventions that these women have been making. So we found out that in Cameroon, the women affected by conflict demonstrate their agency in multiple ways. One is what we call sisterhoods of protection. And so because of the increasing sexual and gender-based violence due to the conflict, women have formed themselves or mobilized themselves into social groups, moving and working together on each other's farms or common initiatives to protect themselves. And these women dedicate some time where they work on one lady's farm or a lady A's farm for a couple of days and then move to the next. And this gives them a self-confidence of knowing that I am protected by my sister. And so that level of protection makes it difficult, or that level of collectiveness makes it difficult for perpetrators to actually attack these women. So they build on their strength in numbers to sort of ensure their own protection. And we also found that such approaches are also not employed by just young women, but also the elderly. They also work together in each other's farms and hide together in times of attacks from armed groups. So this sisterhood of protection has created such collective action which helps women feel protected and safe in the violent context, especially given the limited national and international support to these communities. Another way that women demonstrated their agency that we found is through the family care and protection. Given that the conflict is ongoing and the government's failure to provide socially for civilians, the family is a main source of protection for a lot of these communities, and women have been playing central roles. So you have women carrying their vulnerable groups to safety in times of attack by warring parties. So these women have been engaging in ways that are protecting or supporting their fellow civilians. They have become household heads, taking care of vulnerable members of their family. So you realize that women's role here, the care economy that we know, there is a continuum. It's not just in peacetime, but also in wartime as well. Others also alert their family members of impending violence, so they wake them up in the middle of the night just to go and get safe places of hiding. So this, they contribute to early warning as well. Another is interpositioning that we found. So interpositioning is where elderly women, especially women leaders as well, put themselves as barriers between armed groups and civilians or children that have been attacked to plead for them not to attack them. One participant that we spoke to shared how an elderly woman used herself as a barrier between one of the armed separatist groups. When they wanted to attack a school, and because of her presence and because of using herself as a barrier, the armed separatist groups did not attack the children. So women maximize their role as mothers in their communities because they are often respected by different groups. And another that we saw is also that women forming social groups to educate themselves on dangerous routes and others so that to prevent them from being attacked by different groups. We have women groups such as the Southwest Women Task Force and others engaging in nonviolent resistance and protests, including walking 15 kilometers just to protest for the release of about 100 young people who were arrested unlawfully by the police, and their efforts to ensure that some of these young men were released. So what is equally clear from the findings is that within this context, collective protection underpins a lot of what these women do. So much as their self-protection is important, they often mention that it is always connected to the collective protection of all. So collective action, which we talked about, is very much what a lot of the communities that we dealt with know. Is what they can depend on, given that there are no other support elsewhere. So they depend very much on each other. And this is connected to their common values of Ubuntu that we talk about, I am because you are, and solidarity and all of that. So these efforts present a key potential for WPS agenda because local women and women groups can reach places that maybe international actors cannot reach, and they know the context, they know the needs of the civilians and can reach to them. So these agents, their agency importation must very much be recognized going forward, and you know, collated and best practices disseminated. Of course, there are challenges. Okay, some of them mentioned about increasing distrust and suspicion that was within communities due to the conflict, and this affects their collective protection, because without trust, how can we then share and alert each other of information and able to create that collective protection that they look out for. Others also complained about intimidation from warring factions, including phone tracking, extortion, and harassment. But despite these challenges, these women continue to demonstrate resilience and proactiveness, and they navigate these challenges just to ensure their own protection and that of other civilians. So we heard earlier today about how women on the ground are doing so much with so little, and I believe that all the more reason why we cannot overlook these contributions and stuff. So going forward, I'll say that now more than ever, the BPS must challenge more boldly the rising militarization of the agenda, and that which shapes how women are perceived and supported, especially with regards to protection. We should call for nonviolent approaches to peace and protection. And I think that unarmed civilian protection provide that alternative source of protection that women can use and maximize. And more empirical research into this is very important to highlight the best practices of women groups in conflict affected spaces. Collaboration, cross-border collaboration is very important. And I think that protection is as important as peace building. And I think it should be given more recognition. And so it's important that we move away from the narrow view of protection to a holistic one, which captures women's protection effort in conflict spaces. Thank you.
That was really compelling. Thank you, Nancy. And now over to Stephanie, please.
Good evening, everyone. We've spent the day in a workshop talking about similar themes, and we've been teetering between hope and despair. And Dr. Kirby's wake notwithstanding, when I see a room full of people doing extra time, extra work after hours to learn and engage on women, peace, and security, I'm definitely leaning on the side of hope. So thank you for being here. And something else I think that broadens our perspective on women, peace, and security is the extent to which the agenda has carried in different contexts. And we've just heard some excellent examples of that. So it started as a UN initiative in the year 2000. Of course, lots of precursor events to that. But then it was adopted and adapted in different international organizations and regional contexts. And so you can think about the European Union, ASEAN, the African Union, even NATO. They all adopted similar plans suited to their purpose. And it's with that in mind, and my research focuses primarily on NATO, that I want to imagine different WPS futures on the eve of its anniversary. And just to give you a quick overview of what women, peace, and security might look like in a NATO context. It was adopted a few years later in the year 2007. A big focus on increasing the participation of women in international security, although NATO has limited levers by which it can achieve that because it relies on what its member states do. Another big focus on what NATO calls integrating a gender perspective. That means understanding the gendered patterns of war as they perform operational planning and the execution of missions. And then a few years later, the adoptions of policies on sexual exploitation and abuse and conflict-related sexual violence. So there's less time to evaluate, but still quite a few, certainly more than a decade, that we can assess NATO's performance on women, peace, and security. Within the alliance, there is a special representative to the Secretary General on Women, Peace, and Security, and a staff team supporting that work under the banner of what's called the Human Security Unit. So that gives you a bit of a primer on Women, Peace, and Security at NATO. And then comes the backlash. So the backlash has been well described so far, so I won't go into the various manifestations of that. And certainly for NATO, the U.S. stance on a lot of these issues and actions, and certainly the words of someone like the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, carries. So in response to this backlash, what are the different futures that we might imagine? What are the most likely outcomes we may see? The first future I can describe for you is a future where we obey in advance, right? Professor Snyder calls it anticipatory obedience. And that is a future in which states want to avoid political friction, especially with the United States, so they avoid raising certain issues. And certain files are especially vulnerable in this climate. At NATO, those would be women, peace, and security, the climate and security files, and everything that's branded as human security. So the argument goes, if we don't raise it, it has the better chance of surviving within the institutional structures. We see some evidence of this when we look at the Hague Summit. That's the latest NATO summit that happened in July. When we look at the NATO declaration, usually that's the summary of the summit that's made public after the event, there's 5 bullet points there. It's very short and stands in contrast to previous declarations or communiques that had 30, 40 points outlining all of the issues that NATO found to be a priority, and women, peace, and security was part of that. So at the time, I think NATO was quite worried about its own survival and focused on a common denominator approach. And so I think while we focus here on women, peace, and security, there's something to be said more broadly about the prudence and extreme caution that we're seeing in diplomacy nowadays. So the outcome of this future is stalled implementation. And this is important for international organizations and governments that have adopted national action plans, because institutional memory can be lost very quickly in addition to that momentum. A lot gets lost in transition in governments and in international organizations. There's high staff turnover. So the expertise and the institutional memory, if we follow that future, can quickly evaporate. Another future is along the lines of institutionalized resilience. And that means that things that we've seen in the past characterized the Women, Peace, and Security agenda, that high visibility performance of women, peace, and security might no longer be the focus. For NATO, there was a big public diplomacy push around women, peace, and security, certainly very visible on its website, certainly celebrated by several secretary generals in their public speeches and during women, peace, and security anniversaries. Even Angelina Jolie visited the NATO headquarters for a joint press conference with the Secretary General and penned an op-ed with him, really promoting the merits of women, peace, and security. So a lot of externally facing work happened in the past, and I think that that's unlikely to continue. Last year, in 2024, at the previous NATO summit in Washington, where NATO was celebrating its 75th anniversary, a new women, peace, and security policy was adopted with a lot of pomp, and it was a high visibility event. So a lot of that external facing work then will transition to more internally facing work. NATO is a large bureaucracy. It's got both civilian and military actors working in day-to-day on implementing policies, and it got its marching orders in 2025 with this updated policy on women, peace, and security. And there might be a case to be made now to just hunker down and focus on internal mechanisms of implementation. NATO is a machine that grinds on with the policy anchors that are in place, and that's done through its civilian and military structures. And that way it stays a bit under the political radar, but you're still seeing what we might describe as policy incrementalism. You're not going to see big splashy advocacy for women, peace, and security, but you're not maybe going to see the institutional memory disappear in the way that I outlined in the first scenario. The third, a future is a more optimistic one, and that would be a growth in feminist foreign policies. And we are seeing some political momentum in terms of certain countries either adopting feminist foreign policies or keeping feminist foreign policy legacies as part of their foreign and defense policy apparatus, having had them in the past, or countries renewing their national action plans on women, peace, and security. And here, the vector by which you might see some action is through mini-lateralism, so smaller coalitions of states that are friendly to the women, peace, and security agenda and who want to press on. Within the NATO context, there are new members like Sweden and Finland that have considerable expertise on women, peace, and security and can be now part of these mini-clusters of states advancing women, peace, and security in different fora. And here we might see, if we play out this future, something that looks a little more like targeted policy advancement. So nothing revolutionary, but handpicking a few files that can be advanced through that quieter diplomacy amongst like-minded states. A few examples of what that could look like in the NATO context. It could be to revive an informal network called Friends of 1325, where there's still political attention through it via the NATO ambassadors, but it's a quieter form of diplomacy within the halls of NATO. Something else, money is always important. These countries investing into women, peace, and security trust funds. NATO has one of these. You can find them in other international organizations. And then the final one is focusing on training. NATO has an organization called, it's a Swedish organization, but for NATO-certified training, called the Nordic Center on Gender and Military Operations. And so increasing the scope of the type of training that center provides can continue to increase the awareness and visibility of women, peace, and security through less visible channels, but nonetheless, some could argue are meaningful ones. So that's where I'm going to end it, three futures, and I think we see some evidence of all three playing out in the last few months, but hopefully it provides a bit of a more optimistic take on where we are.
Thank you so much, Stephanie. And then over to you, please, Aiko.
Great, thank you. How's the sound on that? Can you? Great, thanks. Thank you so much, Catherine, my fellow panelists, everybody who came, especially those of you who have just spent 3 hours in my company. I'm flattered. I had forgotten that we had promised to be critical yet constructive, and now I'm worried that I'm going to fail at that task, but here we go. So I would like to start with the contention that I think we've all kind of alluded to, which is while anniversaries of 1325 have always been, an occasion to mark, there's something different about this one. It feels very different. Because since the passage of 1325 in the UN Security Council in the year 2000, feminist scholars and advocates have, of course, noted gaps in funding and in the implementation of policies and promised initiatives. Since then, feminist scholars and advocates have also debated the strategic prudence of placing questions of gender, peace, and security in the bastion of militarized and masculinized politics, that is the UN Security Council. They've interrogated the implications of using the agenda to argue for women's increased participation in militaries via peacekeeping. And they've highlighted how singling out sexual violence out of its context can at best impede understandings of conflict and at worst serve as cover for military invasions. I've always been sympathetic to these critiques, but I have also argued, alongside most feminist commentators on the agenda, that this is something nonetheless worth engaging, that we can perhaps make strategic use out of, even though it's an imperfect object. But in the past 3 years, these debates have been somewhat eclipsed by the catastrophic failure of many WPS actors, the Security Council first and foremost, to do or even say anything meaningful about the unfolding genocide in Gaza, as well as Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine. And here, just to be clear, I of course don't mean that such large-scale military aggression should eclipse gendered concerns, which somehow stand to the side and are a separate question, which is precisely what great power politics has done. To the contrast, just to give an example, we have a wealth of analysis about the gendered dimensions of these conflicts. So, in Monday, the Security Council's open debate on 1325, or Women, Peace, and Security, was held well in advance of the anniversary on Monday, and there Professor Noura Erekat spoke powerfully about the deliberate targeting of Palestinian reproductive capacity, from the effects of sexual torture to the bombing of IVF clinics, to the conditions under which pregnant people live and are forced to deliver babies, and to the constant threats of life under which children are raised, pointing to the devastating impacts on the possibilities of Palestinian life now and in the future. And she characterized these as a form of reproductive genocide, which is, of course, highly, highly gendered. And so we can see that gender is integrally woven through the logics and conduct of these forms of violence, rather than a subsidiary consideration that can, you know, only be attended to once the fighting stops. And so, while the agenda is, I argue, clearly failing on its own terms in the face of current events, simultaneously, it's under intensified attack as an object in and of itself, and this is what my fellow panelists have alluded to, right? I've been studying anti-gender mobilizations, often but not exclusively by far-right actors, across the world for a few years now, and initially doing that work at the same time as studying peacekeeping in WPS was like living in two parallel universes. On the one hand, anti-gender actors were fomenting panic about anything evoking the term gender or anything conceding the existence of non-heterosexual identities. These range from panics around children's school books in Hungary, as documented by Dorothea Redai, to objections to the Istanbul Convention in Turkey, discussed among others by Alev Özkantac, to the withdrawal of rainbow-colored cakes from bakeries in Lebanon, as documented by Sophie Cham in a recent paper. So this was happening on the one side. On the other side, in the sphere of WPS and Security Council politics, feminists were mainly noting how gender was becoming a depoliticized term, alternately linked to concepts such as operational effectiveness or reduced to women in a kind of add women and stir approach to gender mainstreaming. So for a while, it felt like depending on where you look, gender politics were either technical and depoliticized or the most incendiary thing you could think of. It was an odd place to be, but now that gap, as we've heard, is narrowing. We've heard Paul has already mentioned the development aid budgets that are shrinking in favor of military spending. But the agenda is also being attacked as part of a strategy of dismantling anything to do with gender. And we've heard about the self-styled US Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, announcing that the Pentagon was scrapping the US military's WPS policy. So, according to that brief stock-taking, at the 25th anniversary of the WPS agenda, we know, one, that the agenda is an imperfect policy, which I don't think is a contentious claim to make. Two, that it's failing spectacularly in response to contemporary conflicts. And three, that it's under a new form of attack tied up with transnational anti-gender politics. So taken together, these lend renewed urgency to engaging with feminist debates over how to relate to the agenda. In the face of these kinds of attacks, should an imperfect object still be defended? And if yes, how? Here I want to suggest that we can learn something important from Aaron Belkin's reflections on his work advocating for the rights of gay, lesbian, and trans people in the US military. In a conversation piece with Dean Spade, Belkin underscores that these politics are less about being committed to inclusion as a goal in and of itself, and more about resisting exclusion. So the point that Belkin makes is that the exclusion of gay and trans service members from the US military was never articulated in the form of queer anti-militarist resistance. It was mobilizing logics of homophobia and transphobia to try and effect on politics of exclusion. And so that's why Belkin characterizes the work that he undertook as informed by the need to contest these kinds of homophobia and cissexism as logics of meaning-making wherever they come up. Extending this thinking, we might note that while critical feminist and Pete Hegseth may both be wary of the WPS agenda, their suspicion stems from very different motivations. So following Belkin's reasoning, we might consider that there's worth in resisting regressive politics and regressive ideologies. Yes, anti-gender politics are also a form of gender ideology. Though we should resist these as a logic of means-making and as a political rationale. So while the WPS agenda has many problematic aspects to it, resisting attacks against it that intend to restore a heterosexist and patriarchal gender order are nevertheless politically worthwhile. And so in order to resist these attacks, I think it's important to study these forms of anti-genderism. As I mentioned earlier, many progressive policies and activists were targeted before the WPS agenda. So there is, and I think thankfully so, a large and growing body of literature and organizing to learn from and of what to do in this situation. This is crucial because we need to understand not only what's being defended, but also what it is that's being resisted. And I know we have a short period of time, but I just want to mention two things that work on anti-gender politics teaches us about relating to WPS. So first, the attacks on gender and any policies and initiatives related to it sometimes mobilize public sentiment and affect in ways that play in, you know, populist politics. But many of them are highly organized, globally networked, and well-funded endeavors with strategic vision. They're not only emotional responses to kind of specific policies or things that are going on. And this is where I think the terminology of backlash has some limitations, because it suggests that's what's happening is some kind of mechanistic reaction to progressive gains. And so, taking from that the strategic nature, I think there's certainly space for pedagogical and political engagements with people caught in the middle of this debate, or people unsure which way to go, but it's also important to be aware that, you know, these are not just spontaneous reactions and that there's something highly organized behind this in terms of where you want to spend your energies on who to persuade. And second, that we can learn from anti-gender attacks, it shows that it's crucial to investigate the linkages between different forms of political attacks. It's no coincidence that these are targeting, in different places, but often on remarkably similar terms, reproductive health and rights, women, gender, LGBTQ people, racialized subjects, and migrants. This is, again, because what we're seeing isn't simply a backlash to specific laws or policies, but rather it's a future-oriented program that seeks to consolidate whiteness, maleness, and hetero and cis sexism at the heart of power. Basically, they're coming for all of us, and that means that WPS policies and activisms, if they don't adopt an intersectional stance at the moment, that is going to play further into these divisions. But the note that I want to end on is that we shouldn't let resisting anti-gender politics dictate the kinds of work that we do, such as it is, each in our specific locations and capacities. And so over the past several years, I've had the pleasure of learning from Dr. Florence Waller Carr's doctoral research here at LSE on how civil society actors in different parts of the world conceptualize and enact women, peace, and security. And Florence's work points to civil society understandings of peace as something broader than the absence of militarized conflict, as contra what the Security Council thinks. and also as envisioning WPS as an agenda that requires attention to intersectional questions of reproductive justice and attending to diverse sexualities and gender identities. But further importantly, Florence's work affirms the notion that WPS is also a community building tool, and this is something, Paul, you've spoken to and written about with Laura Shepherd as well, that WPS has created a community of academics, of practitioners, and of advocates. And, you know, while we may not have the same priorities or the same takes on various political issues, WPS has brought all of these people together to work as part of a larger community. And so while the terms of the debate are changing, I think one reason to defend WPS is that it would be a shame to lose this community, this mode of organizing, and this opportunity for knowledge exchange, especially given the deeply anti-democratic politics that we're confronted with. We need each other now more than ever.
Thank you so much, Aiko, and of course to all our panelists for their deeply insightful comments and for participating in this discussion. I'm really struck by how much this quite difficult birthday of WPS is both encountering these geopolitical complexities and tensions that we are hearing about and all thinking about in our work, practice, studies, and so forth, while also raising what are sometimes familiar, if familiarly difficult, feminist questions about reform, about revolution, about difficult attachments, and about the tensions inherent to living in spaces of paradox, uncertainty, and ambiguity. And so thank you so much for sharing your insights and experiences. We are now, in one moment, going to open the floor to the audience, to yourselves, for questions, as is typical. Please raise your hand. Our friends on the stewarding team will bring the microphone to you. Please wait till you have the microphone to begin speaking so that we can ensure you are heard. If possible, please mention your name and your affiliation. And as there are many of us in our community in this room, I will just ask politely for specificity, brevity, and so forth in the asking of questions. Thank you so much. And now, with that preface, anyone got a question? Yes, please. And just for the microphone, just there. Thank you so much. And put up your hands and I will sort of, we'll start with one while everyone gets brave. Thank you so much for beginning. And then we'll carry on.
Yeah, somebody needs to break the glass, so I will hear myself. Yeah, thank you so much to all the panelists. I'm so grateful to be here. And my name is Marie-Thérèse Atsena. I was born in Cameroon, so I related very much with Dr. Nancy. Thank you for all these details about participation. I am an anthropologist. I was trained in Quebec, Laval University, Canada. And I worked with the UN peacekeeping mission in Mali from 2020 to 2022. So I was a reporting specialist in the gender unit of the MINUSMA when it was still functional, because it's not there anymore. I am so blessed to have heard this perspective, because I was an internal person trying to collect data and implement the policy within the context of war and all of that. I was reading already Paul Kirby, and I'm happy to see him here. So yeah, I'm so grateful, and it's just by accident that I dropped in, and I'm very happy to have heard all the presentations from different perspectives. I have probably one observation and probably one question for Nancy. So my observation is that we have worked very hard to implement the WPS agenda in Mali. We were a team of maximum six specialists in the gender unit. We have tried to combine a lot of expertise to push the recruitment of women, the political participation of women in the CSA, le Comité de Suivi de l'Accord de Paix. We have gotten 9 women. It wasn't that much, but it was already a lot. It was the 30% of the law 051, of the 30%. So as an anthropologist, I have gone all the way to Timbuktu, Gao, and Mopti, and of course Bamako to collect data, and in specific places where we could not have access. So I saw those women, I saw community support, participation, and women leaders. It was very humbling for us from the UN perspective to see those powerful, strong women working in context of war, dealing with all these issues. My observation is that the policy was very, according to me, helpful. The framework was very helpful. It existed and those women could appropriate it and implement it the way they could. So criticizing the policy and in a negative way, at the beginning I'll feel like it's not that fair, because we have worked hard to really associate a lot of perspective. We have created indicators of research. We have worked in many with many techniques. Okay, pardon my English, I'm French speaking. So we have done a lot to include the women and also to let them appropriate their fight. So so for me, the policy worked. That's my point. It worked. It was even more powerful than what we thought in that kind of context in a Muslim country that had 2 or 3 coups d'etat when we were there. And with all these dynamics, the women were active. They were strongly active. From the UN part, we were also very active. The civil society was very active. The president of the WILDAF, Bintu Samake, was hired as the Minister of Gender. So the civil society was included in the government. All of that because of all these dynamics of action. So I feel the policy was very powerful in Mali. Of course, we can criticize a lot of things, but the policy was really good. So moving forward, for Nancy and maybe all the colleagues in the panel, my question is, why would you want to change something that is working? And I understand the idea of moving forward. Okay, I understand the idea of integrating more national plans. Those plans exist, by the way, even in Cameroon. We have the Plan National de Femmes Paix et Sécurité. We have all those plans. The governments are strongly appropriating those plans. So why changing something that is working? That's my question. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your expertise and your experience, and for a really challenging and excellent question to the panel. I think we all appreciate it very much. Before I turn back to the panel, may I ask friends in the audience if there are other questions we would like to ask? Yes, please.
Hi, thank you. We were in a workshop today, and something that we were drawing out a lot was, as we're operating in an increasingly militarized and securitized environment, how does the WPS agenda fit into that? Do WPS practitioners and organizations shift to operate in that environment, or do they sort of hold the line on the principles and values that are at the roots of the agenda? So I'd be interested to hear panelists' thoughts on how that line can be towed.
Right, thank you so much. I think we'll go one here, and then we're gonna come back to the panel, and then I'm gonna sweep the room this way. Yes, please.
Thank you for all of your brilliant reflections. I have two short questions. I'm a Florence and PhD student. Not a PhD,
no.
I'm a doctor. I've just completed my PhD at the LSE Gender Department. I wanted to hear. That's not why I took the mic, but thank you so much. We've obviously spoken about the failures of WPS and some of those traditional WPS leaders stepping away from that in the multilateral global space. I wondered if you saw any new or emerging kind of state stepping into leadership roles. Or evolving relationships both between states but also more broadly, and also where WPS advocates can do better in terms of relationship building, community building and network building in order to respond to, as Aiko said, the diverse political attacks coming from very different angles.
Thank you so much. We'll now return to the panel. See, everyone is making notes. Aiko, would you mind if we start with you and come back down the table in this direction this time around?
Sure.
putting you on the spot, thank you.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, what should I start with? I want to start with validating that I'm really pleased to hear that the policy has been useful and has done work for gender advisors and for women civil society in Mali. And the point of critique rather than criticism here is that two things can be true at the same time, right? That it can be, you know, it's been documented in South Sudan as well, many women activists saying that this policy is wonderful because it allows us to make claims, it allows us to mobilize and so forth. That can be true at the same time as that the policy is not working, for example, for women in Gaza, right? That it can fail in places and do things in other places, and I think that's where the difficulty of having this conversation of what to do next is trying to figure out how to balance those two competing realities. And I'd like to thank you for reminding us that there are also other realities that need to be taken into account in terms of what is useful for us. I think I'm going to stop there.
Thank you very much. Fair enough. Please go ahead.
Yes, brilliant questions. Thank you very much, and challenging ones too. I will speak to the question that was asked on the militarized environments and whether you hold the line or whether you adjust the language in order to get it through, and some of the compromises that you make along the way and how these add up for the integrity of women, peace and security. And in the literature you see a lot written on femocrats, sort of actors within institutions who advance gender equality. And in the military, you have some equivalence in gender advisors who provide advice to commanders and who work with different functions in the military to perform certain tasks. So there's lots of actors within that broader ecosystem of women, peace, and security. And it's difficult work. So we're here and we're talking about a global policy framework, a really imperfect one. But what was really revealing to me as I conducted interviews in various NATO missions and talking to folks who are trying to advance the women, peace, and security agenda on the day-to-day is that it was really hard work and facing a lot of organizational resistance. And so my answer to that question is to say that the strategy evolves over time and depends very much on the interlocutor in that the first time, a quote-unquote WPS champion or a gender advisor has to raise a point tied to gender equality, they might go for the 30-second pitch that ties women, peace, and security to operational effectiveness just to get a hearing. The next time, that person might raise it differently and have a longer conversation and, oh, have we considered the ways in which women's security needs and perceptions are affected in that particular context, or who haven't we not engaged with? The third time might be a longer conversation. But what seems universally to be the case is that they only have 30 seconds that first time, and very often they have to explain to their peers what they do, because these types of positions haven't been broadly socialized within national governments or within international organizations. So that's what I'll say. I think a lot of these actors take a pragmatic approach, which evolves over time, and the pitch changes depending on the situation. And just on the question about who should we think about building relationships with in this moment, and here I'll repeat something I said at the workshop earlier, which is I think academic institutions actually have a role to play. We talked about a community of practice earlier that bridges different sectors that are all active in the space of women, peace, and security, and it's a pretty fun gang. But academic institutions in a context where there is data suppression, where gender disaggregated data is being wiped clean from governmental websites, have to step up as repositories of language. And we need to think differently about strategies of data management. So I think we think about states a lot. And when that, even within states and governments, that space for women, peace, and security is shrinking. And so outside, with the resources and expertise in academic institutions, I see an opportunity to do more. So I'll propose that.
Brilliant, thank you.
Yeah.
Nancy, please.
Thanks. Thank you very much for mentioning that. It's nice to hear that you're from Cameroon and you've done more work on women, peace, and security in Mali. I was in Mali when I used to work with the Kofi Annan International Peacekeeping Training Center, looking at the gender mainstreaming of MINUSMA. And I think your point is correct, and I'll agree with Aiko's point as well. I think the critique is not that it's not about changing the policy, because we all agree that the policy serves as a foundation for what we want to do for women, peace, and security. However, we also acknowledge that gaps must be identified, and challenges must be identified and worked on to improve the policy, and also making the policy relevant of our times and the changes that we are experiencing. So I think it's more about building on it rather than, you know, saying that it is not working, it is not good, or we are changing it. We're trying to build more on it, strengthen the policy now, and so that in 25 years from today, the policy will become more fit for purpose. And I think that there should be spaces for that critique. Because if we don't shape the policy, it cannot remain as it was when it was first adopted 25 years ago. I think it has to transition, it has to evolve, and that evolution is based on the critique and, you know, unpacking and making it more relevant to the to the dynamics of now and the future. So I think that is more what we were thinking, we're trying to do here. How do we operate in the multi-militarized barriers of WPS? I think we should keep challenging it because it is not fit for purpose. We have to think about, but at the same time, we have to find ways of navigating around it. And I think that part of it is, particularly when it comes to more of funding for increasing funding for defense, than for peace or for effort. I think that we should also, to navigate that, and based on my experience, we should begin to look at homegrown solutions, homegrown approaches. How are women working? What are the alternative sources of funding that exist in conflict-affected spaces that we can maximize and build on so that there is a reduction of overdependency on the international? I think that is very important going forward, because a lot of women groups are doing incredible work, and they are doing that. They are doing so based on some funding that sometimes they raise themselves. How do we maximize what they are doing with you know, international funds, so that it doesn't become more over dependence on the international community, but also, and so I think that will help to navigate that space. But I also think that creating more spaces for conversations, I think, is very important, so that we understand each other. The military, for instance, I remember earlier this year, the Canada Research Network for Peace and Security organized a symposium, and it was interesting to see the military personnel engaging with academics and civil society, the creative tensions that happen, because we tend to not understand each other and what they are doing and why they are interested in what they do. And I think creating more spaces around that will create more understanding, and we also get to know the language they want to use and then engage in that level. I think that will help us to navigate effectively around that. On who do we build relationship with? I always say that WPS, and especially in patriarchal society, cannot, or will function all right, but needs more engagement with men. And I'm so glad that we have men on the panel and so many here, because I think that it cannot work without bringing them on the table to understand why this is important, and that for them to understand that gender equality or gender empowerment or women's empowerment is not about taking away your power, but it's about we all working together for the benefit of all. So I think the engaging men, particularly in patriarchal society, on the WPS agenda is very key going forward. But also expanding that to multi-stakeholder engagement, that I come back to my point of bringing different actors together and letting them engage and building relationships amongst themselves is very key as well.
Thank you so much, Nancy. I am really just struck by like the prospect of WPS at 50 that you raised there. That was like incredible. Paul, do you have any responses to the questions? Yeah, and we're going to come back to the audience for one more round.
I'll maybe disagree slightly with my co-panelists in that the WPS framework has been contested, and there are people who are uncomfortable with the kinds of versions of womanhood that come out of it, what it suggests about what a woman is and what it suggests about what a woman does. Understandably, that's going to become much more muted because WPS is on the defensive and wider conversations about gender are on the defensive. But it's not quite so settled, I don't think. I would maybe elaborate on two fronts of the original vision of WPS where I think we can say it is failing. So the first is around women's participation in peace processes, in which there's been really very little movement, and I think for a couple of years, I'm not up to date on the data, but for a couple of years we actually saw a decrease. And there was one point at which the level of women's participation in peace negotiations was lower than it had been in 1999. So that's a bad story. The other area is probably the one that's been most criticized as getting too much attention in WPS is conflict-related sexual violence. And people have really, or had really said, that the problem with WPS is it was too fixated on conflict-related sexual violence. We're spending too much time on prosecutions, too much time on. There is no effective prohibition, international prohibition on conflict-related sexual violence. None of those mechanisms are working, and some of the key mechanisms, particularly the International Criminal Court, are under major, major attack. So I can totally see that in some situations the framework enables things, but I think compared to the vision of some of the people in October 2000, there's some really big shortfalls. On how do WPS practitioners deal with a militarized environment, we'll be lucky if they'll have us, right? Frankly, I've been really shocked and surprised by how much the efforts to broaden the understanding of security that have been undertaken over the space of many, many decades, starting before 1325, to really try and inculcate an idea that security isn't just the security of states, it's not only measured by how many nuclear weapons you have, et cetera, et cetera. I had really thought that it filtered through more into security practice than it has. The minute there was an excuse to get rid of gender, it's gone. It's gone. And I'm more skeptical that it's, you know, three-dimensional chess to appease Trump. The guy's not reading some of these documents in which his language has been removed. So even some of the discursive space, never mind the resources space, is evaporating. But I think the wider point is to break apart our idea that WPS is a single unified thing, and to recognize that some of the arguments, as Aiko alluded to in the example of Aaron Belkin and Dean Spade's conversation, that some of the rationales for WPS and military inclusion are completely different from other WPS rationales. And that's fine. And they can be pursued by different actors with different interests and different resources. And then very finally, I know I'm going on, to Florence's question about what can advocates do better. I think the story of the deepening of WPS over 25 years is also the story of professionalization and technicalization. And that's very understandable. You can't have a conversation about, for example, the draft treaty on crimes against humanity and how to get gender language in that without some very, very specific technical legal knowledge. But it did have the effect, I think, to generalize, of detaching the WPS community more and more and more from social movements and relying more and more on the goodwill of champion states. And now that goodwill is gone, we're a bit stuck. It's very easy to say, oh, just reconnect the social movements and then we'll be fine. That's a very complicated thing, but I think that's where some hope would lie. So.
Thank you so much. We'll do one more round of questions starting here, and then I saw a hand here and here. So those three audience members, please. And then I'll invite everyone else to email us and continue the conversation subsequently. Thank you so much.
Hi, thank you so much for a great panel. My name is Christine. I'm a PhD student in the LSEIR department right at the beginning, so opposite of Florence. I appreciate your point so much, and especially the reflections on the general gender backlash that's happening. And I'm curious on your reflections on strategies for unifying across feminist movements, WPS movements, and kind of, I think, something that the right, the conservatives, whatever you want to do, is they're very good at focusing on the 90% they agree on and leaving the 10% they don't. Whereas kind of on the left, we're more like, of course we all agree that we all deserve rights, so let's debate these 10% of things that we really disagree on. So how do we start to move towards this 90% that we agree in a moment of particular backlash and unifying and having a collective voice? And do you think that's even an issue?
Thank you so much. And then I think we had a hand in the second row of this, in the center section. Yes, and then yourself will be third. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thanks so much to all the panelists. I'm Sophia Poti. I'm a master's student here in the Gender, Peace, and Security cohort, but also, until very recently, part of the peace and security NGO sector in DC. And so building on that and on a couple things that have been touched on, one of the elements here of what's happening at this anniversary, of course, is we've had the professionalization, and now we're also seeing, as we've mentioned, decreases in overseas development funding, but also just the what is now a sizable portion of the WPS community unemployed or soon to be unemployed as organizations are collapsing with that lack of funding and that pulling of funding. And so, and further, and then organizations which do still exist facing not just backlash, but also facing like investigations from the US government, for example, organizations which have provided monetary assistance to families in Gaza now facing accusations of anti-American activity or the like. And so it entirely makes sense that in this period we are, you know, seeing ourselves on our heels or at a point of on the defensive. But I want to ask the question of, is it possible to see this really devastating moment as also a point potentially of transformation where the WPS community could be proactive in potentially doing things like framing some of this anti-gender activity as actually a concern of security and of a concern of relevance to the WPS community in sort of an educational model, particularly as we start seeing some of these far-right actors really make explicit some of these racist or sexist ideas, which up until this point have been framed somewhat more subtly. So I'm asking, is there a way that you think the WPS community could be proactive in actually identifying these as security threats of potential relevance to a larger population that might not have been interested in the WPS framework up until now? But thank you.
Thank you so much. And then lastly, to our friend in the front row, thank you for your patience.
Hello, thank you all so much for your valuable insights today. My name is Manur Umar. I'm from Pakistan. I'm a criminal slash human rights lawyer, but I've also done, and I'm also a student here in gender, peace, and security at LSC. My question stems from this past year where I did some work with the UNODC on coming up with a gender strategy for the police in Pakistan. And a big problem that we kept facing in whatever work we were doing was funding. And I understand that's a problem that WPS agenda is facing worldwide, especially in the current context of so much funding being cut off from the development sector as a whole. So what do you see as the future of, you know, where can funds come from? And I see a big issue in the NAPs, the National Action Plans is also, they write, we're gonna do this and we're gonna do that, but then where's the money gonna come from to do this? So where do you see this agenda in the coming years being, especially considering the lack of funds being given to it? Thank you.
Perfect, thank you so much. All right, panelists, we're gonna come back to you to pick out and respond to the elements of the questions that resonate with you, and I think also in this moment, probably to succinctly share the final thought and takeaway we would like to leave the audience with. Stephanie, do you mind if I start with you this time? And then we'll go Nancy, Paul, and Aiko. I'll leave you a wrap up.
Yes, I will focus on a question, on the two first questions, because I think they can be tied together in terms of strategies and collective action and responding to this moment of crisis in a meaningful way. And I think we all need to sometimes be in that space, if not for just purely therapeutic reasons. But I do think it's time to leverage all of the arguments that we've put in our academic articles or in our research and use every trick in the book to counter the backlash and the global systemic mobilization against gender equality. So that means, you know, putting a lot of pressure on our politicians, parliamentarians. That means going after every remaining available source of funding. You know, Canada has turned to the EU, looking at, you know, EU Horizon grants and trying to find other opportunities there for coalition building and finding funds where they still exist and pivoting a little bit in terms of their strategy and really back to us in academia, because we, you know, we are at the LSC. I think it's one of those times where we may you know, not want to stay in our ivory towers, but want to be a bit more public in our research dissemination efforts, so that this remains a very visible issue and that we can leverage the evidence to counter the rampant misinformation and disinformation. So I think there's still a lot that we can do, even though it's easy to feel helpless. And I, you know, like you, I've met a lot of people who've lost their jobs recently and who are really reeling and who can't even talk right now. But if we have a voice right now, it's time to use it and to use every trick in the book to mobilize the research and the evidence that we have at our disposal. It's very important. And I will say that, you know, looking at the various funding opportunities, just to give you an example, it is easy to frame things as a crisis right now. And the urgency and the significance of this work is quite straightforward. So when we've always believed in the importance of gender equality for international security, but right now there's a more receptive audience to seeing it as urgently needed and a true crisis.
Thank you.
So I will touch on probably two of the questions. So how do we find a collective voice or action in women, peace, and security? I think that in our earlier conversation that we had in the workshop, elements of building bridges, right? Building bridges between women, peace, and security actors in Global North and then in the Global South, I think it is very important. Learning from each other, I think it is very important. But along that is also the coalition building, which I think Stephanie has mentioned, right? And if I can give example for my work in Cameroon, women in Cameroon, because of the shrinking civic space in the context of the conflict, have seen the coalition building give them a more stronger and collective voice than before. So if you're a single NGO organization, you might face certain intimidations that you cannot handle. But coming together in, as a coalition, they are able to get that strong voice to stand and then you know, voice out against social injustices and also, you know, calling for ceasefire. So forming that coalition, for instance, in 2021 led to 80 women-led organizations coming together to form one of such coalition, which led to, you know, organizing the first ever Women National Convention for Peace, bringing together over 1,000 women across the country, calling for peace, calling for an end to hostilities in the countries, you know, the affected region. The conflict-affected regions. So I think the coalition building is also part of ways of ensuring a collective voice and solidarity among women, peace and security movement. And I think that linked to that coalition, I think that it's also element of where the funding comes from. And I know that is a very important question and a challenging one because the BPS cannot go on without funding. And a lot of communities, you know, sometimes they don't have the funding they need and they depend on the little they have, which in itself is very good. But I think that it's also connected to the coalition because I think different organizations coming together means that they can support each other also fine financially. And I think that also that limits also when it comes to international funding, right? If they come as a coalition and money given to them, then get more work done by different organizations within one body, umbrella, than giving so much money to different actors and institutions. So I think that the coalition building and, you know, helps in both the collective voice towards women, peace, but at the same time also an alternative, perhaps alternative source of funding for women, peace and security, particularly in conflict affected communities and societies. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks. I think it is a potentially transformative moment, and if it can force us out of some of our comfortable ways of thinking and working, you know, there are positive and hopeful futures, maybe, especially if we can abandon the boomerang effect that I described and try and generate WPS funding from everywhere driven by social movements and pressure. How will those kinds of advocacy strategies work in the context of anti-gender mobilizations? We need to be creative. I am fearful that it will require a kind of folksy equality discourse, right? You should care about this because you have a sister. You should care about this because you have a mother. Inevitably the game of good feminist, bad feminist, and so on, all of those kinds of distinctions. But as a way to open those conversations, I think that some of us will become uncomfortable with the failure of maybe more sophisticated or critical frameworks in reaching a broader audience and having the more challenging conversations with people who are lured by the idea that it's obvious what gender is, that it's obvious how the family operates, it's obvious what the connection between the family and the nation is. So I think that's a challenge.
Perfect. Thank you.
That might be the last thing between you and drinks. I'll try and keep it brief. I was, now that I had a moment to think, I want to say something about the question of militarism and whether we toe the line. And I think this is also, perhaps my views shifted in the current moment, but I'm inspired here by the work of Kate Miller and others studying militarism and the insight that, you know, militarism is about more than just militaries, right? And especially now with some of the work that's being done documenting, you know, investments, arms companies, dock workers, all of us who pay taxes to governments or so on, that militarism is a much more complex web, and it's really kind of shifted how I think about the debates around women's participation in peacekeeping. And it seems, it's made me much less concerned about particular women, you know, advocacy around women deploying on peacekeeping operations or so on. That, to me, the extra work that does in bolstering militarism, I'm not sure if that's where I would concentrate my energies on resisting this as a particularly problematic thing. And that's a great question about how do we build solidarity. I feel like that's often the finding, that we need to build solidarity and the conclusion at the same time. Again, we all have our strengths, and you know, from the perspective of academics, and I think that's why I was insisting that we need to study how these movements work. Mm. Because part of it is a kind of, to use a militarized metaphor, divide and conquer, right? It's like throw your trans siblings under the bus and then it'll all be okay. And I think that if we're tracing how these movements work, we'll see that that's a losing strategy in the long run. But I would defer to people who are much better social organizers than I am to talk about how that works in practical terms. I know Hugo Emangelo has done some work around these questions in women's civil society organizing. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you so much to all of our panelists. It's been an enormous pleasure for me, and I'm going to go ahead and characterize for yourselves to listen to our panel today. I want to do some quick thanks, and then we're out of here. So I want to say thank you so much to our organizers, Nita Lumi and Nele Leithoff from the IR and gender departments for their work in putting this together. Thank you so much. Great organization, very feminist. I also want to thank our stewarding and events team in the room that has helped us get in and out. And honestly, I also want to thank our AV and podcasting teams who are going to help people who aren't here hear this event. And I also want, okay, yeah, let's do it. And then I'm going to re-thank, so we'll hold on for a sec. I love the energy. I'm going to rethink our event hosts and sponsors, LSE Gender, LSE IR, the LSE Women, Peace, and Security Studies Center, the Canadian Research Network for Women, Peace, and Security for co-hosting this event with us. And, of course, I want to thank yourselves for your attention, for joining us. Yep, this one. I hope we will see you again at events here at LSE, as well, of course, as within the WPS community, whatever and whoever that may be. And now, of course, please join me in finally thanking our excellent panelists.